From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm John Wells.
Chris Fisher, welcome back to Cool Science Radio.
Good to be here.
Yeah, you know, the last time we spoke, August 15th, 2019, you were standing on top of the big boat in Nantucket for expedition number 35. And that expedition went pretty well. What have you learned from 35 now that you've had a chance to be able to crunch a lot of the data that you collected?
Well, it's interesting because I believe we're getting ready to head out on our 37th expedition now. And we have actually really started to see the piece of the puzzle come together. I think one of the biggest shifts that's occurred since last year, that over the last 5 years or so, we thought that these large white sharks were gathering off of the northeastern United States and Nova Scotia. And our original hypothesis was that they were going up there to mate. There's a lot of big males, a lot of big females in the same kind of general area, plenty of food for them to endure a significant period of time to attempt to kind of collide with one another and have an opportunity to mate. But we've been digging deep into our hormone data on all these big females, and we've also been digging deep into the sperm motility and the sperm volume of the large males. And when we look at the data that we have seen coming out of both Massachusetts and out of Nova Scotia, we're just not seeing peaking hormone levels in the females, a lot of estrogen. We're not seeing a lot of testosterone in the males. We're not seeing big sperm counts in the males. We're not seeing highly motile sperm in the males. So we're really starting to believe that this fall aggregations, late summer, fall in that region, are primarily feeding aggregations. I like to think back and try to, when I work on the ocean, I try to take the science, which can get really complicated. I'm not a scientist, but I've been supporting hundreds of scientists for a long time. I try to blend it in with the practical knowledge we have from working on the ocean for several decades. I also really try to leverage things like Occam's razor. You know, like the simplest explanation is most likely the correct. And I feel like on the ocean, that's really true. So what I was leaning toward when it came to Occam's razor in the early days was, you know, there's a lot of big males and there's a lot of big females in the same area. You know, in the ocean, typically when you see fish come together, they spawn to aggregate. They aggregate to spawn. Right. Mm-hmm. They don't spread out to mate. Right.
Right.
So that was kind of what we've been leaning on for at least 10 years. But then we started to really think about it when we saw these tracks unfold for these animals. The Nova Scotian sharks are going back to Nova Scotia. The Massachusetts sharks are going to Massachusetts. We got some other sharks now that are really starting to show us things evolving in Newfoundland. And so if you think about a species that's evolved for hundreds of millions of years, what's the most fundamentally important thing they might need to endure change and survive? Well, that would be genetic diversity, right? And so we started to see the same groups going to Nova Scotia, a different same group going to Nantucket, a different few sharks going over to Newfoundland. And we're like, okay, well, if those sharks were mating there, they would all be going back to the same area and be mating with the same groups of sharks that only go to that area. That would not maximize genetic diversity. That would actually begin to narrow the genetic diversity.
Right.
But if all of those sharks from those different groups collided somewhere else and had an opportunity to mate, that would maximize genetic diversity. So if all these animals are spending the late summer and fall in these individual feeding aggregations, probably where their genetics are taking them from their family group, because that's where their family group went to feed, kind of like a salmon back to a river.
Right.
That would not maximize genetic diversity because they'd always be mating against the people that they see every year in this one spot versus all the sharks on the Northwest Atlantic. That would maximize genetic diversity. So we started to really look at some of these other areas where maybe the sharks are spread out in a much, much larger area, but all the sharks from those different areas are in that region. And then they maybe occasionally bump into each other on an artificial reef or on a dead whale or, you know, someplace that kind of causes a few of them to come into real close proximity to one.
Right, right.
And so we're beginning to believe, for a couple of reasons, the hormone data, the sperm data, semen data, and also Occam's razor, that they're not mating up in the Northeast and in Atlantic Canada, that these are truly feeding aggregations. And one of the other things we did is, because the OSearch can follow these white sharks across their entire range, right, all the way from the Gulf of St. Lawrence and Atlantic Canada through Nova Scotia, Newfoundland, across the East Coast, down around the Southeast and into the Gulf, we're able to sample these animals across that range and check their hormone levels, inspect their sperm volume, sperm motility. And one thing you can learn is, maybe you haven't found where they're mating, but you know where they are not. And when you started to work across a significant component of that range, because you're mobile, you can be like, okay, we have to start looking in some places we have not looked yet.
Right.
And so there's not much of their range yet that we have not looked at. And that is becoming one of the primary focuses for our 2021 expeditions.
Well, I'd like to mention to our listeners that the Shark Tracker has been completely redone, a new version of the app. I was taking a peek at it this morning. I've got the new version. And Miss May pinged at 7:32 this morning. She has a very deliberate and consistent route that she's been taking over the last couple of years. I have a couple of questions. One is, do these sharks travel alone, or do they travel with companions? When we see them moving in these consistent patterns, are they alone?
I think for the most part, yes, they are alone.
Okay.
Now so these animals have, like you said, very predictable, repeatable migratory patterns or migratory loops, right? Mm-hmm. The migratory loop of the male is much simpler once he's mature. It's almost the same. It just expands from when they're born, and it gets bigger as they mature. And it's basically a one-year migratory loop, mostly coastal. Of course, they're using the continental shelf, and they come offshore sometimes. But these animals have both a coastal and a pelagic component, a big offshore component. But the male is much more coastal, super simple. And once they're sexually mature, right, they don't have to modify their migratory loop because they get pregnant, because they're a male. So they have a much simpler migratory path. They do repeat them precisely, and they're oftentimes triggered by the moon. We see animals making moves north or south almost on the same moon phase every year if the temperature of the water is reasonably close to normal. Right? So they're getting pushed around by water temperature. They don't like it if it's too hot. They don't like it if it's too cold. But typically on an average year, the water temperature is transitioning around a certain moon phase, whether it's triggering them to move north and that moon phase is in June, or it's triggering them to move south and that moon phase is in November or December.
Right.
And the water happens to be warming up in the south and pushing them out anyway in June. And then the water happens to be cooling down up north in that December timeframe, pushing them south. So it's definitely highly connected to the moon. These sharks know exactly where they are, and they know exactly what the date is. We see the sharks, when you look at how often they ping, you'll see that the sharks don't come up and ping as much when there's a big moon, because they can orient themselves and they can feel and see the moon from beneath the surface of the water when the moon is really big.
Yeah.
As the moon gets smaller, particularly with the waning crescent and the waxing crescent moon phases, you'll see we get a lot more pings during those moon phases, because it's like they got to come up, orient themselves, their tags out of the water.
Sure.
We get more pings. Now, I'm going to answer the question. The migratory loop of the female, once she's sexually mature, is more complicated because it gets interrupted with a pregnancy. And then they have to go gestate and give birth.
Of course.
So we see the migratory path of the female change a lot somewhere between the age of 15 and 20 when they transition from being an immature animal, can't mate, have babies, to a mature animal. So that makes it a little more confusing. Now, these triggers on the moon phases and the temperature of the water, it's kind of all triggering the animals at a similar time, but we believe they're making their own way. It's not like they gather up and then they all start moving on a certain moon phase. So might they be all loosely heading in the same direction, spread out across a month or so? Yes. Are they all gathered up together and swimming north or south in a school? We do not believe so.
Okay. I wish Lynn was here this morning so we could talk about how men are more predictable than women. But
you know, the life of the female white shark is much more complex than that of the male white shark.
And speaking of female sharks, Saria was tagged 10-foot, 4-inch mature female. She was tagged off the African coast of Mozambique. And I got this from your Twitter feed in November of 2018. A couple of years later, April 2020, she was found 800 miles off the Indonesian coast, a transoceanic journey of more than 4,000 miles. Saria has the longest confirmed migration for the species on record.
So that's one of our great partners in South Africa. You know, oftentimes when OSearch moves around the world, we'll work with some scientists and put a big collaborative team together, and then the ship moves off. Mm-hmm. A lot of times those scientists will continue their work with what they can do, and then they call and ask and say, hey, man, I love that everyone could follow my sharks. Can we put these new sharks up on your tracker?
Right.
So we're like, yeah, put the sharks on the tracker. We'll try to drive scale toward your project to help them have more awareness and funding. And that's done by a great guy down there, Dr. Adam Barnett, his partners in South Africa. And that was fascinating. Everyone was fascinated to see if this shark was going to make like a full migratory kind of transition across the Indian Ocean. And she made it almost all the way. Now, just because she didn't ping doesn't mean she didn't make it all the way. She could have easily just gone underneath the surface of the water, gone to the coast and come back. But we do have a confirmed data point that is a massive migration for a large tiger shark across the Indian Ocean. And all this new work we're doing with these scientists and the work we're doing, it's why we're learning so much so fast, right? We're able to get the latest technology on these animals and really, learn more in the last 15 or 20 years than all the time up to that point.
Right. So we have a non-human half to us as humans. We've got 38 trillion, mostly bacteria on our skin and in our flora, in our gut, and sharks do as well. We have not been around a couple hundred million years like sharks have. They're truly prehistoric. When you check their teeth for bacteria so that you can let the local cities know what sort of antibiotics they should have in case someone is bitten by a shark, are you finding bacteria that is more evolved or different than the bacteria that we have in us?
Well, I think the single biggest observation between what we're seeing with the sharks and like a human is their bacterial communities, particularly in their gut, is much, much simpler than ours. Uh-huh. So I think that they have evolved to only what they need and have gotten rid of a lot of things that we may carry that we haven't shed yet that's going to really enhance our capacity to endure time. Like right. the bacterial community of the gut of a white shark, I know, is getting ready to publish. And our scientist, I believe she's out of Georgia Southern, who's focusing on the gut part. Mm-hmm. She is just stunned at how simple the bacterial community of the white shark is compared to ours. Mm-hmm. The main focus on these bacteria things is, you know, we think that the bacteria on their skin is working with their immune system for this rapid healing.
Right.
And so we're doing drug discovery development around that. You know, we're finding new antibiotics. We have a big antibiotic problem as a human race. We're running out of antibiotics. We need these new sources, novel sources of antibiotics. No one's ever been able to get the live bacteria off these animals because they haven't had the kind of access we can present to the scientists and let them go alive. So we're getting live bacterial communities, which you don't get off a dead shark.
Right.
And so that is fascinating. And then in their mouths, the bacterial community is identifiable. We can then recommend current antibiotics, and it might also lead to new antibiotic developments. But I think the thing that really stunned us, again, when you think about in terms of evolutionary time and natural selection, and you think of something like a white shark, which is so efficient, right? It is naturally selected out basically almost everything it does not need because they have been evolving for hundreds of millions of years. And so they've evolved down to what is simple and what works and what can endure time. And so when you think of a species like us, we're still so young as humans on this earth that we still have all the stuff maybe we needed 10,000 years ago, but hasn't been naturally selected out because the process is so slow over time. in our bacterial communities, I believe if we were really to pin down a scientist, I would think they would say that the bacterial community on a human is much more complex, a lot more bacteria than you would find in a white shark, because they have had time to select out everything they don't need. They are a very efficient machine.
Well, the data that you're collecting is not only good for people that are trying to understand the oceans and the inhabitants of the ocean, but this kind of data is going to be important for all sorts of different research. If they've been able to simplify the flora and only be able to encourage and develop the flora that they need to get certain things done. I mean, that's fascinating. This is going to cross over to all sorts of different research. Another question that I have for you is that some blood samples collected during a South Africa expedition shows high levels of heavy metals in poisonous metals in the bloodstream of these sharks, of some sharks, and it doesn't seem to affect their health. Have they been able to build up defenses against this?
So that was a paper we published with a big group of people. You know, we have 55 peer-reviewed published papers now, and yes, another 40 coming. And that's what happens when you bring a big collaborative team together, yeah, with capacity. So we did see incredibly high levels of mercury out of these South African sharks. Well, one of the reasons the shark research doesn't, most people don't connect the dots on, is understanding the physiology of these white sharks is an excellent indicator of general ocean health. Because these white sharks are at the top of the food chain. So they are known as what is called a bioaccumulator. A tiny fish gets eaten by a small fish. All the toxins pass into that little bit bigger fish. That fish gets eaten by the next biggest fish. All the toxins pass up, right? And so all the toxins within and general ocean systems are passed up through the food chain. And the top, the apex predator, the top of the food chain is the bioaccumulator of everything that was consumed up until it consumed the bigger things right below its level in the food chain. I hope that made sense.
That makes perfect sense. And
so bioaccumulation is a huge program that we have in understanding all of this toxic, how toxic the sharks are and so forth, can give you a picture of general ocean health. Because they are accumulating all of the toxins across and up the entire food chain. So number one, that's alarming because these things have high levels of mercury in them. That means the general ocean health of the region is pretty toxic, right? Now, how are they physiologically dealing with it? It doesn't seem to bother them. Do we have our head around that? No. What are we seeing in the North Atlantic since I got this data not too long ago? We are seeing higher levels of mercury and toxicity in the animals in these white sharks when they're up off of Atlantic Canada and Massachusetts, mm-hmm, than we are seeing in them when they're down off the southeastern United States between like Cape Canaveral and Cape Hatteras. Right. The biggest difference in what they consume in those regions would be marine mammal, right? Down off the southeast, they're eating a lot of fish and squid, crabs, whatever they want, the odd dead whale. When they're up in the northeast, they're eating a much more steady diet of seals. So is that connected? You know, but I think the most important thing is, number one, obviously you never want to eat one of these large sharks, right?
No, not
highly
at all.
Toxic. Number two, how do they handle that? Number three, do we have a general ocean problem? Because our apex predator, the bioaccumulator, has alarming rates. I can't remember off the top of my head, but I believe that South African study said those white sharks might have had 40 times as much mercury in their system as a human could endure.
God.
Now, maybe I'm wrong on the 40. Maybe it was 10 times, but it was a crazy number.
Yeah.
I haven't read that paper in a long time. So how does that affect our general ocean health? Does that mean when we eat a tuna, it has too much mercury in it? Does that mean when we eat a snapper, it's the building block of the mercury that rises up the chain into the white shark? Are our fish too toxic? That's what's really important about this conversation.
Back to Occam's razor, huh?
Yeah, right. What's the simplest explanation is likely the right one, right?
Right. So you spoke earlier about Cape Canaveral, Florida to Cape Hatteras, North Carolina. That's a territory that you call NASFA, Northwest Atlantic Shared Foraging Area. What's the significance of that piece of territory?
That's a very good question, John. I would say we misnamed it. when we first figured it out.
Okay.
We had all the sharks from Nova Scotia heading there, all the sharks from Massachusetts heading there, all the sharks from Newfoundland heading there, massive area, pinned, cool water, pinned against the southeastern coast of the United States between Hatteras and Canaveral, cold water pinned on the inside up against the beaches by the Gulf Stream, right? The Gulf Stream winds, kicks off Cape Hatteras, winds out to the northeast, you know, winds out a couple hundred miles offshore, comes back in tight again at Hatteras, gets really warm from there and there on out, too warm for a white shark. But it pins a cold body of water against the beach. And that sliver of water is not like 1 mile wide, right? It's like 120 miles wide some places, 50 miles wide others.
Sure.
They're all in that area. All the sharks from the different parts of the Northwest Atlantic Ocean are arriving in that area. But it's a huge area. They're all spread out. We used to believe that the white sharks were likely mating up in the Northeast and Atlantic Canada. Because they were all closer together and tighter in these areas around seals. And then they would go down there, spread out in this massive area, feed across the winter, thus the shared foraging area, right? It was shared by all these different groups, and it was in the North Atlantic. So it was the North Atlantic Shared Foraging Area, NASFA. Kind of a terrible name. I need to work better on branding. I think we're going to have to rename that area, John, but I need a little bit more data before – we have the capacity to rename that area. I do not think it's just a shared foraging area anymore.
You know, Cool Science Radio is very interested in encouraging STEM education, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. You all have a curriculum in 250 different languages, which is provided at no cost to educators, to parents, to kids. How is that program going?
Program is amazing. We have a collaborative group of teachers around the world, really, who leverage the TAP tracker, and they write individual curriculums for their students. This is in the early days, we wrote all the curriculums with our partners down in Houston at the Houston Aquarium, because they had a full education team down there. They wrote so many and continued to write some that other teachers started to use them and then leverage the tracker for new lesson plans that work for their students. What we were then able to do is those teachers would open source their educational curriculum to us. We would send it down to the education team at the aquarium in Houston, as Landry's donated all this stuff. And they would take that curriculum and conform it to the next generation science standard. So it was the most modern conforming STEM curriculum it could. And suddenly the amount of lesson plans we had skyrocketed, right? Because people wanted to help. They were using the other plans. They would provide theirs. And so it's just continued to evolve. It's available in the English and metric system. I think it's used in dozens of countries, and I think 49 are the U.S. states now. And it's just what it does. You're trying to layer things, right? Here we have this super important charismatic research program around white sharks. It all started because the kids just wanted to track the white sharks. And then we were like, wow, we got kids interested in science. That's not always easy. And so then we started to add a math problem on the movements of a shark today. And suddenly the kids were having fun doing math because they were tracking a shark in real time.
Right.
And that just grew and grew and grew. So now the kids can engage in a real science project. They can watch all the science going down on the OSearch YouTube channel or Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, whatever. They can tweet a shark, ask a question. They can learn oceanography, physics, mathematics, learn about marine debris, all in the middle of a real white shark program that they're following in real time and seeing it when it happens, tracking sharks, learning math. And it kind of gets them in the whole system of being engaged with the ocean, science, and then help them get the skills they need to be not only able to look after themselves and their career in the future, but for me, the biggest single thing is to try to help them understand when it's their turn to take care of the planet, they need to be a data-driven centrist.
Right.
They need to just follow the data. One of the biggest challenges we have in managing the planet and the ocean to abundance is emotion.
Yeah.
There are so many people around every agenda that they're so emotional that they get position oriented. And if the solution is not everything they want, then they want nothing.
That's right.
In the midst of a decline, right? So the path to abundance is an unemotional journey. It is nothing but math and science. And so we want them to be those centrist resource managers of the future. So we're trying to have them come into a real project, open that up. No one's ever really done that for them, integrate it into the skills they need for their life and to be the resource manager, the centrist of the future.
Right. Well, the fundamental question, of course, is how do we get kids interested in learning? And this is certainly a great way. And I also get a kick out of the fact that there's a lot of adults that have the shark tracker and they're commenting on their favorite shark. And they've gotten pulled into this education thing. Maybe they're not doing the curriculum, but they are absorbing scientific data and becoming a little bit more analytical in their problem solving, which is great. A final question on the education. Are you still spending a lot of time in the schools with kids?
Oh yeah. I mean, I speak to school kids all the time. Obviously during this year, that's transitioned a lot from in-person to via Zoom meeting or whatever. Absolutely. But I think also what's happened was in the early days, I had to do all of that. Now posted around the country, we have these amazing educational ambassadors who are some of these teachers who were heavily involved in the curriculum, and they're going and hitting a lot more classrooms than I could hit as an individual.
Right.
Because they're posted in different parts of the country. The OSearch educational ambassador can go speak to the kids. The educational ambassadors have a lot more online learning opportunities. We just had a virtual science camp at Jacksonville University, which is the academic home of OSearch. And those educational ambassadors ran that. So it's continuing to become more robust and fill out and not be so much of a one-man show, you know, which is better for the kids and allows us to touch more people and really, you know, just try to move everybody toward the middle.
Right. Well, Chris, we're almost out of time, but maybe you can take a minute or so and just tell us about 37, which is coming up.
Expedition 37 will be off of Massachusetts. We're continuing to build on our work there, really trying to get a lot more of this hormone data and a lot more of the semen data to confirm what we're seeing and trending. That's in August. Expedition 38 is in September in Nova Scotia. We will have a full month on the water there. We will continue to build on the white shark population we discovered there a few years ago. This has been the most transformational, I think, pivot of the white shark research program. No one really knew much about the white sharks in Nova Scotia, thought there was just the odd wanderer up there. Turns out, I think that the white shark center of the North Atlantic Ocean is Atlantic Canada. There's more white sharks up there. They're using parts of Atlantic Canada we never dreamed of. You know, first we found some in the southern coast of Nova Scotia, like, oh, a few make it up here. Then we tag more down off the southeastern United States, and they're going to Newfoundland. They're going all around, even north of Nova Scotia, into the Gulf of St. Lawrence, over into New Brunswick. And we're going to continue to build on that research and explore some new spots during the month of September. And then we'll be back down at Jacksonville University with the ship by around late October. So we're getting really ready to go into our busy season, two back-to-back expeditions with about a two-week break in between.
Well, we'll set something up and speak to you again.
Look forward to it. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Chris Fisher, who is the founder and the chairman of OSearch. Thanks.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. If you missed part of the show or you want to share it, all our shows are posted within the hour on kpcw.org under the Shows tab.
We also podcast all of KPCW's Public Affair Hour shows wherever you find your podcasts, so you can find them under KPCW and the individual show name.
So look for KPCW Cool Science Radio and take us with you on your next road trip or commute. We'll be right back.